March winds and April showers make way for sweet May flowers. And then comes June, a moon and you.
Hello and welcome to episode 14, the April Showers edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. Yes, yes, I know, it's not quite April as this episode drops, but since March is a three-episode month, and since this week's events all take place in April, I thought I'd take the liberty of ignoring the last 2 days of March and moving right into April. It just feels better to be in April anyway. So we'll start off with a look at some feel-good music, explore the story of Easter through art, and discuss the upcoming production of a play by a MacArthur Genius Award winner. It only takes about one or two bars to recognize a song as one by the Doobie Brothers. Their unique sound is one that never seems to age. For Vinnie Brandy, it was the inspiration to get some of his friends together to form a Doobie Brothers tribute band and hit the tour circuit. I managed to talk to Vinnie via phone between gigs.
I know you're pretty busy, so the first thing I want to do is just appreciate the time you're taking to do this interview. It's really, really kind of nice of you, and I'm sure that the listeners are going to really be pleased to be able to get a little insight in what you guys are doing. So how about we kick this off with giving us all a sort of an idea of how you got started in this tribute band business for the Doobie Brothers.
Well, we had a bunch of musicians. We're located in the Berkshires out in western Massachusetts. That's kind of where our core group is. And we had a handful of musicians here who were hardcore Doobies fans. All really into the Doobies music since back in, like, you know, when they hit the scene, probably like the mid 70s. And we were always talking about putting this thing together, and, you know, once the tribute band market started to really kind of find its groove, maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, and, became a big market, you know, in theaters and performing arts venues. And we said, well, we've been talking about this. Why don't we do it? And we put it together, and we really took the time to pick the songs apart, learn all the parts, the harmonies, all the instrumental stuff. And, we put it together, and this was probably, I'm going to guess, we got up and running in like 2018. And since we did it, it's just been nonstop, and seems to be a pretty good contingent of Doobies fans out there who want to hear this. We want to hear this great music. So that's how it all started. And, luckily we've been plugging along pretty good.
Did you expect it to be this successful, take off like this?
Well, we were hoping it would. You know, you never know until you put something out there, and you put something out, and the general public will tell you whether it's good or not. So you put it out there, you keep your fingers crossed, and it's been really successful. People love it. The tunes are, most of the tunes are instantly recognizable. The really unique thing about the Doobie Brothers is that there are really like two almost completely different incarnations of the band. When they first came out, it was, Patrick Simmons and Tom Johnston were kind of the lead guys, and you had songs like China Grove and Long Train Running, Listen to the Music. And, they had a guitar driven sound that, people, they were huge at that point in time. And then when Tom Johnston left the band and Michael McDonald came on board, was like a totally different sound. It was, keyboard driven, a lot of it, and more soul influenced, and, you know, songs like What a Fool Believes and Minute by Minute. So between the two different incarnations of the band, there's just a lot of great music there, and when people hear these tunes, you know, it just instantly connects.
Yeah, one of the things that you know, I remember about the Doobie Brothers growing up and their music was that it was just some of the, the way I describe it for myself is some of the happiest music around. I mean, when you listen to a Doobie Brothers tune, you almost can't help but, you know, feeling good about yourself and getting up and moving and having a good time.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, most of the stuff is, you know, up-tempo, rocking stuff. And even the songs that are more laid back, songs like, say, like a Black Water, even though it's kind of a, you know, more laid back kind of a tune, it still is a very, like, you know, upbeat, positive kind of a feel to the song, you know. So yeah, you're right about that. Everything is kind of puts a smile on your face when you hear these tunes, and people, I think, forget about some of the tunes until they actually come to the show. And they're there, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, wow, that's a great song, you know. And I haven't heard that one in, like, you know, 20 years, but they're all great tunes. I mean, they're still out there now. They kind of have, they've got a reunion tour they started, I think, like last year. But the music, this stuff just never goes away. It's just great stuff.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And I was actually going to ask you, as one of my questions, you know, what do you think are some of the more, I hate to use the term, you know, unrecognized, but the songs from the Doobie Brothers that kind of, you know, sink in the background that people perhaps don't recognize quite as quickly as listen to the music or taking it to the streets that you think are really good quality songs?
Well, they have, they actually covered a couple of Motown songs and had big hits with those. Take Me in Your Arms was one of them, and that's a great tune. And then another one is Little Darling, which is a great tune. So they covered a couple of Motown songs. They have, you know, it's like Rockin' Down the Highway, which is a great tune that, you know, something you don't hear every day. Dependent on You, which was a great tune. And then we have, like, well, people will recognize like 90% of the songs in the show. We try to throw in like one or two deep, like album cut deep track kind of things, just to maybe people will be like, oh, I've never heard that one before. Pretty cool. You know, I mean, my people basically want to hear the songs that they know. So we keep it mostly to that, but we always throw in one or two in the show just to kind of, you know, put it out there, and maybe people will hear a Doobies tune that they really weren't familiar with. But South City Midnight Lady is a great song. We throw that one in there. I think there's maybe about close to 20 to about 20 songs in the show. So it's there's a good amount of songs in there.
So give me a little bit of background on your bandmates there. What kind of instrumentation do you have? How many you got?
So there's seven people in the group. There's a lead singer. There's two guitar players, a bass player, drummer, keyboards, and percussion. Seven people all together. Five of us sing. Lots of backups and harmonies going on in these tunes, and you know, the Doobies' vocal skill was pretty incredible, and so was their musicianship, but especially their guitar players. And we have all that covered with our group, which is nice.
Yeah, the vocal harmonies I always found to be one of the big attractions of their music, because they have some really tight three-part and even four-part vocal harmonies that just really are terrific to listen to when you've got the voices.
Yeah, those, I mean, they were great singers, and we've picked all that apart, learned all those parts, you know, and then we've got some outstanding singers in our group. So which we, you know, which you couldn't do without. So luckily we have that. But yeah, we try to put it out there just as they did it. And you know, it's so far so good. You know, it's been working pretty good for us. So that's a good thing.
Well, you know, the most amazing thing about the Doobie Brothers, I think, and I don't know if you'll agree with me or not, but I think it's one of those groups that you recognize the group itself, you know, the Doobie Brothers, and you know their music, but the individual musicians that made up the Doobie Brothers don't really stand out in people's minds.
No, that's true. That's true. They basically know, you know, just like you said, they know the name. They know the name of the group, the Doobie Brothers, but most people are just, you know, they recognize the band name, but they really don't know the individuals that you know, that played. And they did have a fair amount of turnover you know, in their existence, so maybe that kind of plays into that. They had a lot of guys come in and out of the band over the years, but yeah, you're right. It's basically their, you know, the sound that people recognize. I mean, when you hear a Doobies tune, you recognize it like instantly. I mean, you hear the intro to China Grove. I mean, it's like instant, Long Train Running, you know, it's Blackwater, it's all that stuff. So yeah, it's much more of a band than it was like a bunch of individual big name guys.
Do you have any insight on I've always been curious about this, but I've never read anything about it, but how they got the name the Doobie Brothers, where did that come from?
I think it came from probably, you know, Doobie being a slang name for marijuana, and I think they were the band originated in San Jose, California. They were basically like a bar band, and there might have been some guys who, I'm not sure, but maybe they came that name came from some of the guys' habits or whatever. Can't say that for sure, but that may be where it came from.
Well, I would probably agree with you, just in the sense that, you know, that was always sort of like, again, when I was growing up, that was sort of always like kind of an inside joke, you know, oh, the Doobie Brothers, right? Yeah, but then I remember, you know, Frank Sinatra always had that Doobie Doobie Doo kind of thing.
yeah.
I wonder if that had anything to do with it, like the kind of Doobie harmony or that they were famous for.
Yeah, it could be. Maybe they took it from Frank, you know, who knows?
Who knows, right? I like to think it's probably the other way around, you know, that 60s vibe was everywhere, right?
yeah, you never know.
yeah, you never know. Do you guys, how many concerts do you do a year?
Well, now that we're back up and running, I mean, before the whole the COVID thing happened, we were probably doing maybe, you know, 30 something a year, and then right now, you know, we're pretty heavily booked, so it seems to be kind of gaining momentum. We were up and running for maybe about a year and a half before everything stopped, so. You know, we were probably doing in 2019 maybe 30 something shows, and with a whole bunch more booked for 2020, which kind of, you know, got put on the shelf. But now that everything's back up and running again, a lot of those have been rebooked, and combined with the new bookings, things are gonna start to get really busy. So we've got a lot on the books now, and you know, I think it's just going to build.
Yeah, I think so too. I think you guys got, you know, actually as a tribute band doing the, you know, the Doobie Brothers music, I think you guys have really, really hit on something, because I can't think of a single person who, you know, likes music that doesn't like the Doobie Brothers. I mean, even if you say, well, their music is, you know, whatever, you still can't help but the fact that music makes me happy every time I listen to it, and that's a real catch for it.
Yeah, I've really never heard anyone. I mean, we know people all over. We've played all over the place with all different kinds of stuff, and I've never heard anyone say that they didn't like the Doobie Brothers. So I think they're just one of those bands that just about everybody enjoys their music. I've never heard anybody say, I don't like the Doobie Brothers. There's a lot of people who love the group and a lot of people who like the group. But the music speaks for itself. So I think that people, when they hear the music there, I think they're just, like you said before, it makes people happy. You know, it's hard to believe now, but this music was really made in the 70s and 80s. So, I mean, you know, that was actually a long time ago now, you know. So,
yes, it was.
it brings people back, to younger days and good times and stuff. So I think, that kind of plays into it too.
Yeah, yeah. I know it does with me. Well, listen, I know you're pretty busy, so I won't keep you on very long. But again, let me thank you for your time. I know the people at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House are looking forward to having you come, and I hope we get a big crowd for you out that night.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to coming to Fredonia, and hope everybody comes out and has a great time, and we'll see you on April 8th.
April 8th, that's it. Yep, okay. All right, thank you, Vinny. Thank you for your time.
Okay.
It's very much appreciated.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Taking It to the Streets, tribute to the Doobie Brothers, will be performed on Friday, April 8th at 7:30 p.m. at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Tickets are $20 general admission, $18 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. Call the box office at 716-679-1891. Or go online at www.fredopera.org/tickets to get yours. No one has influenced the shape of Western history more than the man called Jesus Christ, and the story of his death and resurrection has inspired artists for centuries. The Art and Architecture series will be showing the 90-minute, high-definition, exhibition-on-screen production of Easter in Art, the greatest story ever painted, on Saturday, April 9th at 1 p.m. I spoke with distinguished professor of art Alberto Rey to discuss three of the artists featured in the film, especially about their use of light in their work. Once again, a hearty welcome to one of my favorite guests, distinguished professor of art Alberto Rey. Alberto, welcome once again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure working with you, Tom.
Yeah, and I like having you on. I think maybe I'll find a way to carve you out a regular bi-monthly appearance or something like that.
That's fine with me.
Yeah,
fine,
great. Great. So we have this exhibition on screen film coming up. It's part of the Art and Architecture series at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, and it's called Easter in Art, the greatest story ever painted. And it's basically a curated look at some of the great paintings of Western art and sculpture as well that focus on the Easter story, the story of Christ's death and resurrection. And one of the things, you know, about Western civilization, when you look at it and its connection to the art world, is how tied in the Catholic Church and its imagery and iconography and story is to the development of the art scene in Western civilization. Why is that? How did that happen? What's the overall view there?
Well, one of the things is if you were an artist, you needed to have somebody sponsor your work. So you had more or less three major options. You had either a private patron or a business patron or the church. The Catholic Church had lots of money. And one of the things that was important about the church and why the artists wanted to work with the church is because it was a public venue. So if you got your work commissioned by a church, it would be available for the entire public to see. And it was a great way to promote your work. So if you did a work for a private donor or a private sponsor, it might end up in somebody's house. And the only people that would see it would be other donors and friends. So the best way to promote your work was through the church. And the church at the time, but throughout history, has had a wealth of money and willing to support. And all the cardinals or popes always wanted to be remembered by the work that they left, by the artwork that they sponsored and left behind.
Yeah, I think that certainly makes a lot of sense. And I know that the Catholic Church was invested in it because one of the ways they managed to get their story told was by pictures, because most people, you know, back then, the vast majority of people were illiterate. So seeing the artwork in the churches really helped them tell that story and keep the faith.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for a lot of them, they were actually included in the artwork. So it was another way of continuing with their legacy.
Right. So let's dive a little bit into it. I went ahead beforehand and had you pick three different artists from the, because we can't cover them all. So we decided to pick three different artists. And since you're the distinguished professor of art, I decided to let you pick the three you wanted to talk about. So why don't we get into that? Who's the first artist whose work you'd like to discuss that's going to appear in this documentary?
So we're going to talk about Michelangelo. Now, Mike, everybody knows Michelangelo. The reason everybody knows Michelangelo is because he could do it all. He could not only do it well, but he was exceptional, probably one of the best, not only muralists, but sculptors and painters. I mean, even to this day, if you look back at his work, you're like, how could this person do this? And that type of legacy and intimidation for artists continues to this day. If you look at any of his sculptures, it's just phenomenal. And he's a person just like anybody else, but he had this skill and had this commitment to his work that just allowed him to produce a ton of great work. And his work really influenced artists for centuries afterwards. One of the things I'm going to talk about briefly, because it affects the other two artists we look at, is how he uses light in his paintings. If you look at most of his work, the compositions are fully lit. That means that there is light on the whole composition. Everything is important. The figures are fully formed by shading and color, but everything has a full sense of light. So if you look at his murals or his paintings, you can see how he controls that. He wants to create this environment where everything in the environment is important. And his use of figures is pretty important because during, you know, the 1500s, the use of space and perspective was still pretty new. And the way he was layering information and figures and buildings created this sense of space and perspective that had not been done this well. And so people were just mesmerized by how realistic it looked and how this layering and sense of space was being done now that wasn't done in the past. And again, just the sheer volume and quality of the work just continues.
Well, when I was, I think, I don't know how old I was, 12 or so, I think, when the World's Fair, 1964 World's Fair in New York City was up, and the Pietà, which I think is one of the pieces featured here, was at the Vatican exhibition room. And I remember going through it three times because it was, you were on a runway and you had to kind of, you weren't allowed to walk or linger. You just had to stand on the ramp and it slowly brought you by so that they could move the crowds. And I wanted to go through three times. And one of the things I remember being so struck about was the way that the stonework captured the emotion. I mean, the face of the Christ figure, the face of the Mary figure were just so full of emotion to me. It was I remember being at 12 year olds, like, this thing is going to jump to life any minute.
You right. know? And it's marble.
Yeah.
You know? You know, once you, if you break off a piece of that finger or arm or leg, you can't put that sucker back on. That's it.
That's it.
And yeah. those folds are just super thin. And just like you're saying, it's just so elegant. So it's not only the technician that he was, but just the aesthetic, spiritual beauty that he was able to create with something as unforgiving and as difficult as marble.
Yeah. Yeah. A rare talent in the history of Western art, for sure. Who's the next artist we're going to discuss?
Caravaggio. Ah. Now, the thing with Caravaggio is he is the complete opposite of Michelangelo. Every artist after Michelangelo was like, he was the god. You had to kind of do things the way Michelangelo did. A lot of preparatory work, a lot of drawings, a lot of layering images, layering glazes. Here comes Caravaggio. He decides that he's going to use dramatic lighting, only like a spotlight on these images. And he's not going to do any drawings. He's going to do everything completely from life. So if you look at his work, it's like a spotlight, very dramatic. Something called chiaroscuro, which was more or less the control of light in a way that makes it very dramatic. Everything is kind of focused in, very different. And he was also, well, Michelangelo died at 88, mm-hmm. and which, you know, if you can work that long, it gives you a lot of opportunities to make good work. But Caravaggio died at 39. Mm. And the reason was that Caravaggio got into fights all the time. And he actually had a contract on him. He actually murdered somebody in Rome, had to leave Rome. And he ended up dying on the way back to Rome after he got a pardon. Because the cardinal at the time wanted him to do some more work, but he ended up mysteriously of a fever on his way back, and his body was never found. They just started to do some DNA work on a set of bones that they believe now that they are Caravaggio. So kind of very strange, crazy life, much different than this kind of rock steady, just work ethic that Michelangelo had set up. And so a lot of Caravaggio's peers, artists, were just, not only were they kind of upset that he was kind of breaking from this classical mold, but he was creating this sense of realism in his work that was unheard of. It was unlike anything before. And a lot of his commissions were rejected because they were so real that they considered them vulgar. Wow. That some of the information they put in that in previous times have been smoothed over or glossed over. He didn't do that. He put all the imperfections that these individuals had. And that's what made the work so powerful. The gestures, the narrative, the storytelling, and the brushwork that he developed more towards the end of his life. So he's probably one of my favorite artists just because of the control of light.
Well, I had to agree with you in a sense. The piece that they're going to show, I think, in the film is the Supper at Emmaus. But I have another story about that, too, because I went to London for one of the theater department's like London tours back, you know, a number of years ago. And I took the time to spend to take the channel to France and 7 hours. I spent 7 hours in France and I went to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa, which was a disappointment. We'll talk about that another time. But as I was going through, all of a sudden, there's a Caravaggio, it's a crucifixion. And I was like, I just turned around and it was there, you know, just like it was there. And it like knocked me right over because the way he has that light, you know, figured around the crucified Christ, which just fades all the way to black around the edges of the painting, was just stunning. And it's like, wow. You know, that was my reaction to it. I know that's not a sophisticated reaction, but wow.
No, I mean, it's and especially for the time, it wasn't like there was a lot of other artists doing it to this magnitude. The amount of realism and control of light was just, you know, shocking. And I mean, if you can, you know, this is before, obviously before photography. So you see something like this, it's got to be just mind-boggling to see something this realistic in a two-dimensional form.
Yeah, absolutely. So who's the final artist?
We're going to go with Rembrandt.
Rembrandt, all right.
And Rembrandt, kind of an interesting guy. I think everybody's heard of Rembrandt. But, you know, he had a kind of an interesting life in that he never left the Netherlands. He was pretty much a portrait artist. That was his trade, but he did a lot of religious imagery as well. His life was filled with, you know, sadness. He was married, his wife died, and then all four of his kids died. And he did have a partner, but through his wife's inheritance, the only way he could keep her fortune was if he never remarried, so he never did. Hmm. But he was able to just continue to do these portraits. And one of the things I like about Rembrandt is very similar, and I think he was influenced also by Caravaggio, was his lighting, if you look at Rembrandt's lighting and his work. But one thing that Rembrandt did that took it a step further was that, especially later in life, he was one of the first artists who actually applied paint to the canvas with a palette knife. He wanted to create so much thick gestural brushwork that he felt that this was the best way to do it, to not only start with a paintbrush, which would again start with something smooth, but to actually start with something that was thick, and then you could carve into it on the canvas. This was something that was fairly new. And so if you combine that with the lighting and the gestural kind of spiritual signature mark making, it goes beyond realism in that it incorporates a sense of personal mark making that cannot be done with, you know, washes or glazes. So it was pretty important. And then his prints are really beautiful. Again, controlling light, but for the small scale that they are, he was able to put in a lot of information, and a lot of his religious imagery, especially from the prints, was very powerful. He unfortunately died a pauper, unmarked grave, and then a few years later, as they do with all people who pass away without any funds, they dug up his body and destroyed it. Oh. So there's no more remains of Rembrandt anywhere.
You got some really interesting insights onto their life, the lives of these guys. That's really a fun little thing to think about.
I think is the reason I say all that is because I see it in the work. You know, an artist, like a poet, like a writer, it reflects their life and their work. So you can't separate the two. So whatever happens in your life kind of intuitively comes through the painting as well.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the people who go to enjoy this this particular documentary, Easter in Art, are probably going to get a better insight into it when they watch these particular, you know, artists come through. I also, there are so many others we could talk about, Rubens, Dali, Da Vinci, Leonardo da Vinci, but I think we're going to leave it at the three, Alberto. And let me thank you for the time and that you give us all the time. And I really appreciate the expertise so that you know, the listeners can get a good little extra insight into what they're going to see.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It's always a pleasure. I'm certainly not an expert, but I'm looking at it as a fellow artist looking at other artists' work, and this is what I find fascinating about their work, and I wanted to share that with everybody else.
Great. Thanks a lot. I'm sure we'll have you again, Alberto. There's more films to come, so you take care until I get a chance to talk to you again.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom.
All right. Bye-bye. Easter in Art, the greatest story ever painted, will have only the one showing on Saturday, April 9th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 for general admission and $10 for students. To purchase tickets, call the box office at 716-679-1891 or go online at www.fredopera.org/tickets. Here's what else is going on in the region for the next 2 weeks. The Ecstasis 2.0 Student Recital Series has its second performance on Friday, April 1st at 12 noon at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. This curated event, featuring students from the studios of the Ecstasis duo, Eleron Avni and Natasha Farney, will feature gems from the solo and chamber repertoire of classical music. Admission is free. Donations are gratefully accepted. The exhibition New Shapes from Old Tropes continues at the Marion Art Gallery in the Rockefeller Art Center at SUNY Fredonia until Sunday, April 10th. Admission is free. Guest artist and jazz saxophonist Brad Laley will be in residence at the Fredonia School of Music on Thursday, March 31st and Friday, April 1st, with concerts on March 31st at Domus Fair, 41 West Main Street, Fredonia, featuring the Fredonia Jazz Faculty Collective at 5:30 p.m. and then again at 8 p.m. and also with the Fredonia Jazz Ensemble on Friday, April 1st at 8 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. Admission is free to all events. Between Thursday, April 6th and Friday, April 7th, the Fredonia Clarinet Ensemble, All College Band, and the String Chamber Ensemble will be giving concerts in King Concert Hall and Rausch Recital Hall. These free events all begin at 8 p.m. Also performing between Monday, April 11th and Thursday, April 14th will be the Fredonia Percussion Ensemble, the Camerata and University Chorus, and World Mallets. These concerts also begin at 8 p.m. with free admission. Finally, the cinema series continues with two offerings. Cyrano, a musical version of the Edmond Rostand story starring Peter Dinklage, will be shown on Friday, April 2nd and Tuesday, April 5th. Also, the documentary The Automat, a tribute to the Horn and Hardart chain of window dispensing restaurants, will screen on Saturday, April 9th and Tuesday, April 12th. Showtimes are at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $7 for adults, $6.50 for seniors and members, and $5 for students and children, and are for sale at the door only. Please check the show notes for links to more information on these and other events. Tickets for events at the Opera House can be purchased online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. Tickets for all campus events can also be purchased online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets or by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501. If you'd like your arts events mentioned on the podcast, just send us an email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Please allow 4 weeks advance notice for a timely mention.
Well, I can share things that I have. I have a couple of things that are about to go up, which is I've written a play, Pipeline, and it is about, in large ways, it's about the school-to-prison pipeline. In small ways, it's about a single mother who works in a public school and sends her teenage son to private school, and when an incident happens in that private school that threatens him with expulsion and potential charges, you know, she has to figure out and reconcile with her choices as how she's chosen to send him to the school and what that means for him and how she can save him from the school to prison pipeline.
I'm a writer of color. I'm a black woman playwright. I'm a part of a marginalized class. And in theater right now, we are still working to make space for ourselves to be seen on stage and produced on stages. And it means that I have to get in conversation with theaters often and advocate for my work and advocate for a new audience so that the old guard that's in theaters right now is not the only audience that has to exist, that theaters' audiences can start becoming more diverse, just like the writers who are writing for theater, which I'm a part of, you know. So it's about making space for everybody's voice to be heard.
We Real Cool, the pool players. Seven at the Golden Shovel. We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz June. We
die soon.
Those were the voices of playwright Dominique Morisot and Morgan Freeman reading the poem We Real Cool by Gwendolyn Brooks. Ms. Morisot, whose work as a playwright won her a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in 2018, has been on the forefront of artists of color pushing for more diversity and inclusion in the American theater. I spoke with guest director Yao Khalil, who is directing the Department of Theater and Dance's production of Pipeline, which will be presented in the Marvel Theater from April 8th through the 10th.
It's a privilege to be able to welcome Yao Khalil to the show. Yao is the guest director for the Department of Theater and Dance production of the play Pipeline by Dominique Morisot. Yao, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I'm glad you're here. Let's talk a little bit first about yourself. You know, you're a guest director, so you're new to the area, new to the department. Give us a little background about yourself.
Okay, well, I'll pretend I don't enjoy speaking about myself.
Okay.
Yes. Well, let's see. I am currently the artistic director at the Paul Robeson Theater in Buffalo, New York, at the African American Cultural Center. We're right now in our 54th consecutive season. And I am also, my undergrad and my master's was done in theater performance at the University of Buffalo. And I'm also a PhD student at the University of Buffalo in the Africana and American Studies department as well.
Are you a native Buffalonian?
I am. I am originally from Buffalo.
Okay. And how did you come to become the artistic director at Paul Robeson?
Ooh, good question. That was just about the fall of 2020. Mm-hmm. I did apply for the position through the recommendation of an employee who was working there at the time, who, you know, informed me that it was available. I did put in the application, and I actually was working as the front office manager, is where I started working for the African American Cultural Center. And when the vacancy became available for the artistic director position, I kind of did a lateral move over into that directing position.
Well, good. Congratulations. That's
Thank you.
You know, you're working at one of Buffalo's more significant theaters. Let's talk about what you're doing at SUNY Fredonia. You've been a guest director. I think that they were looking for, you know, a guest director to do this play Pipeline. And tell us a little bit about the play itself. What do we got as a plot? Characters, so on and so forth.
Well, it's Dominique Morisot, so we know there are already many different layers.
Oh yeah.
of things that are taking place in this particular production. You know, it's very, very interesting because it's not something that's very uncommon, but you have these students who are in this production My cast members, they had to keep reminding me that these are not college students who are, you know, in this play, because they live a very college-like life. Mm-hmm. You know, this private high school where they're away, staying on campus, in dorms rather. And, you know, it was interesting because a lot of them really could not necessarily relate to that as their high school experience.
Interesting.
It's their college experience, you know, but it's not their high school experience.
Right.
And so it's interesting that Dominique created this world where this particular Black male student who is away, you know, sent away to this private school with a very college-like experience to provide better opportunities, but it seems most importantly to try to curb some of his anger and his rage, and to hopefully put him in a position where he could be better, have better, and not become a statistic, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And so there's a lot of that happening in this show. look, one of the bigger things, obviously, is that there is this point of racism that's in there, you know, and I think what's interesting is that it was the one thing that a lot of the students actually did familiarize themselves with, because they know what it's like to sometimes, as students of color, be the only representation in their department or in their classrooms, you know, throughout the semester or throughout their entire academic career, and having often found themselves to be called upon as the representative for their entire race or community or culture, you know, to respond and answer specific questions, you know, on behalf of everyone. And the main character, you know, one of the main characters, Omari, in this production, he starts to feel the sting of having to be the representative for an entire group of people at a moment where he is dealing with a lot of inner conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a very, very intense struggle, I would imagine. Absolutely. The play gets its name from Pipeline, from the idea that there's a direct pipeline, it seems, from public schools to the criminal justice system, especially for students who grew up in the inner city and go to those kinds of public schools. How does the play handle that particular issue?
Yeah, it's the school to prison pipeline. And so here, Dominique, she uses the story Native Son by Richard Wright as the catalyst for the confrontation that takes place between Omari and his teacher in the private school system, where, again, he is being pinpointed as the representative for an entire race of people. And so here in this particular work, it becomes a matter of, how do I want to explain this? So he's working on his third strike. Omari is working on a third strike, and we know three strikes and you're out in terms of the legal system. And so he's working on his third strike right now. And I don't know how much of the plot and the story I want to give away, but, you know, but in this piece, he has an actual physical altercation with his teacher, where from his point of view, it wasn't what it seemed to be to everyone else, mm-hmm. based on what he was dealing with, you know, the inner conflict. And so because of this physical altercation that he has with the teacher, it puts him in the predicament of the third strike, you know, having to be reinforced, where now he could be going to prison and having charges, criminal charges, brought up against him. And so the rest of the production from this point on is really the fight to keep him out of this prison criminal system, based on someone who you would not really call a criminal, but it was someone who certainly has inner conflict and communication issues with the teacher, and that lack of understanding or empathy for his personal issues creates this whole world where now his entire life is in jeopardy.
Yeah, it's actually it's a very short play. It's only about 90 minutes long, I believe, and it's like, you know, it's no intermission. It's a one sitting, but it sounds like a very explosive environment and atmosphere amongst the characters.
It is draining. No, it really is. I think especially for our performers, it's there are some scenes that are very intense and very emotionally overwhelming, or that, you know, can be. For some of them, this is something that they have to contend with from day to day. and others they're learning to tap in to emotions that they don't usually carry,
right.
You know. And so yeah, it's a very emotional piece. It's a bit taxing at times, but it's a very rewarding story to tell as well as explore.
Let's talk a little bit about the playwright, Dominique Morisot. In 2018, she won a MacArthur Genius Award, and she's currently had some Broadway success as the writer of the book for Ain't Too Proud, which is the story of the Temptations.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think makes her such a compelling playwright?
Oh, that's a good question. But you know, Dominique, she's and just from all the pieces that I've read and the ones that I've worked on, directed, and what have you, she's very in your face.
Hmm.
You know, she's one of those playwrights that is not afraid to make the audience uncomfortable. She's not afraid to say exactly what she feels the characters need to say in order to get this story where it needs to go. She doesn't cut corners, it's very provocative. Even the language that's used is just very provocative. I think that the fact that she's got a very strong grip and idea on the story she wants to tell and how she's going to tell it makes it very compelling, because there's no other way to tell the story except this way when it comes to Dominique.
Yeah, there's one thing that if I could focus on just for a second or two that apparently has some significance in the play, and that's a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks called "We Real Cool."
Yes.
Can you tell us something about that? Because I read the poem. It's really pretty short, but I found it to be like, you know, just real powerful in its phrasing and the way that it just gets right to the point of certain things. I mean, you know, it doesn't screw around. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate the way that Dominique used this as a through line, really, for the entire show. This poem is woven completely throughout this show, and I really exploit that.
Good.
And in this production, I'm really exploiting this poetry by Gwendolyn Brooks that's in there. But I love how there's this one scene where Naya, she takes the time to explore this poem line by line with her students and making this comparison to the way that it was originally published by the Broadside Press, I believe it was, as opposed to the HarperCollins version, which completely puts it into a structure or a box that it was never meant to be put in when Gwendolyn did the piece. You know, it's got almost like this broken English component to it, and how it's written in this graffiti style, and all of this is there. And Dominique, she explores how, in a way, HarperCollins tried to erase the Blackness from the way that this piece was meant to be viewed as well as read.
Right.
And so I find it really interesting the way that this all comes together in this play.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to mention about the production?
Well, I think there are... I am doing something a little different with this particular showing the pipeline that I have not seen in any other production. I didn't set out to try and do something different, but while we were going through the process, there were a few things that really stuck out to me. So I'm incorporating certain rhythms, certain timing, in this production. And so the main character, Omari, he's actually wearing cat shoes.
Huh.
And we're playing around with the idea of it reminds me a little bit of the Hines brothers tapping through life.
Right.
There's something about keeping his own timing. I'm excited to have everyone experience what when I tell you they have been working in rehearsal. They are really, really, really doing a fantastic job in the rehearsal. And so, you know, you have that moment where you say, I hope and pray that everything translates from rehearsal to the stage. Because, you know, you get into these shows and sometimes it's like the rehearsal is the best part, you know. Because you get so attached to the material and to into everything. But it's really going to be a beautiful piece. And even just the staging, the scenic design, like all these different components, everything. For me, I do a lot of work in symbolism. I love, when you get to know me, you'll know that I do a lot of symbolism. Everything on stage has a point, it has a purpose. Nothing is arbitrary, all the way to the little cracks that are going to be in the walls. It all means something. It means something to the world of the character. It means something to the inner process, the inner workings, the tinkerings, and the thinking of the character. And so there's something to be said about this set that will have like all these beautiful crack designs into the floor and on the walls, you know, because for some of them the world is falling apart. And so there's a lot of symbolism that you'll find in this piece. So I would just encourage all the listeners to look for the symbolism and then question it. Question everything that you see on stage, because everything that you'll see is there intentionally and has an absolute purpose.
Wonderful. That's great. Yeah, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate your time. I think I could talk about this play for a long time, and looking forward to seeing the production. So thank you very much for taking the time, and good luck. And I wish you and your cast the best for your performances.
Thank you so very much for having me. I look forward to having you with us.
Pipeline will be presented in the Marvel Theater at the Rockefeller Arts Center for 3 performances only, Friday, April 8th and Saturday, April 9th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, April 10th at 2 p.m. Tickets can be purchased from the campus box office at 716-673-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. Finally, don't forget to register for the 5th annual 1891 Run for the Fredonia Opera House, which will take place on Sunday, April 24th, 2022, beginning at 9 a.m. The run, or walk if you prefer, is a 5K distance on mostly flat ground through the village of Fredonia and the SUNY Fredonia campus. This year's event will be completely live. There is no virtual option, as in the past 2 years. Registration is now open by going to www.fredopera.org and following the links for the 1891 run, or using the link in the show notes for this podcast on its Podbean site at aisleseat.podbean.com. This is a major fundraiser for the Opera House and helps to support all the many programs and event series presented by the Opera House. If you can't make the run, please consider making a donation by following the links to the registration website and making your donation there. And that's it for this April Showers edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Mr. Vinnie Brandy, Professor Alberto Ray, and Mr. Yao Khalil for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like to feature on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll see about featuring your event. please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. Notes from the Aisle Seat will return in 2 weeks on April 13th, 2022. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.
So just keep looking for a bluebird and listening for his song. Whenever April showers.